In the classic old-time movie A Star is Born, Judy Garland sings this song late at night in a cabaret. It's called The Man Who Got Away, and it's about the once eager suitor who doesn't call anymore. She says good riddance, but you kind of get the idea she'd like to win him back.
Because of the man that got away.
You do not get the same idea from Angela Dufresne's cover of the song. In a video that's part of her exhibit on view now at the Kemper Museum, you see Angela with her tousled gray hair singing this song at the top of her lungs while doing things like riding a lawnmower, dancing naked in drainage pipes, and hoeing in her yard, I think. Angela, are you hoeing? Is that what you're doing?
Yes, I'm hoeing.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR Central Standard, we're going to hear about the artist who's becoming contemporary art royalty. She's had shows in places that artists dream of name-dropping, places like PS1 in New York, the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles, and the Brooklyn Academy of Music. She's had a Guggenheim Fellowship. She teaches at RISD. But she's from Olathe, and she comes to the art world with a few things to say, not to mention a story to tell about growing up gay in the religious Midwest, really struggling to come out, and then creating a body of work that rewrites art history and, as we just heard, rewrites pop culture a little bit, too. Angela Dufresne, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And I realize now I should have sung a little bit more. The man that got away.
Yeah. Love it. Tell me about that song in particular. I was cracking up watching that video at the Kemper.
I'm glad you liked it, or that you cracked up at least.
I did like it.
It's funny. It's a film. Of course, it's an iconic film in queer culture internationally, I'd say. I don't think that there is a city or a town I've gone to that I haven't met a queer person who's either enamored or mortified by Judy Garland. She was adored by me and my mother growing up and staying up late at night on the couch in Olathe, me getting my pop culture education from HBO and Cinemax in the, you know, baby days of cable television. And we had similar tastes in terms of fabulous camp, you know, torch singers.
You and your mom did?
Yeah, she absolutely did. Yeah. I think we more watched kind of traditional melodramas. The Barbara Stanwyck films were all time favorites. Anything with Liz Taylor, Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. I remember watching with her and us sort of realizing this kind of together, this kind of strong woman that was the only one able to sort of say the white elephant in the room, call it what it was, like in the family dynamic, the problematics of the authoritative father and all that stuff, that we would just love, like, seeing these things, I think, that we both desire to happen in reality, happen in film. And I think I aspired to kind of jump into that frame, which is,
I think, wish fulfillment thing.
Yeah. And I think seeing me jump in the frame and also, I mean, there's intentional humiliation and absurdity in me trying to become Judy Garland in any way, which I address in satire in that video. But this idea that maybe some of these classic cinematic lessons are moralizing, or if anything, just life lessons that could be learned and could be really useful.
What is the life lesson that can be learned from your take on this?
Participate. I think, you know, I mean, I'm really into obscure experimental films too, but Cassavetes, as you saw, there's a lot of Gina Rollins in the show. I'm dating myself. Obviously, I was raised by 70s parents, like baby boomers. You know, I'm a classic Gen Xer. But rather than just sit back and watch things, like, really, you can glean so much really good resources from watching anything if you actually empathize and experience cultural production in a highly participatory way. And I think watching things is watching film, listening to music. One of the most memorable moments of like pop culture where I was like, oh, this is a weird, I wouldn't like, this is a really weird, beautiful, sublime moment where some of the boundaries that we think exist in culture got dissolved was at the Grammy Awards in 1996, and Aretha Franklin sang for Pavarotti. Hilton Knowles writes about this wonderfully. He's a little skeptical. I'm not.
What did you love about that?
There was a fusion of American gospel and soul music with classical Italian opera, with a very, I mean, at this point, popularized Italian opera. And her performance was, I mean, I don't know if pathological is the right term, but it was so gigantically effective as generating pathos, like pathos moving emotive power, that she was able to fuse the history of opera with gospel and with her body and with those pipes and with those like smiles and hand gestures in amidst the performance, that it just, I'm thinking about it now and I'm getting chills, like I'm getting excited. And that was a cover in a way. I think about it as a cover, and I think I gained positions to be like, okay, I may not be able to do this beautifully, but I want to participate in these objects.
You can do it as you.
Yes.
I mean, my favorite scenes in that video, it's a toss-up between the singing naked in a drainage pipe, which has that singing in the shower effect on the voice, but also there's something so funny about watching you just absolutely pound at the earth with a hoe to the song, The Man That Got Away. Uh-huh. And then I don't know what is funny about it.
Yes.
It is, but it is funny.
And I don't know why I did it. I mean, I sort of do. This is something that I was talking about a little bit in the museum yesterday. It's something that interests me in the Cassavetes films and in experimental films. It also interests me in conceptual art and in the history of modernism, where people have always tried to dissolve the space between life and art. And, you know, for decades, I think people have talked about how painting can't do that, and that performance, video, and all of these things, who knows, maybe all of it's true, and maybe this is futile, what I'm trying to do, hence why I'm interested in doing it. But this sense of, I had to dig up the path between our house and the garage. And I was also in the process of recording myself singing this song over and over again. So I'm like, okay, I have to do this. And I'm making this video, so I'll do them at the same time. And so it became this sense of, it became this process, this method of doing what I needed to do and combining it with making the song. So I performed the song in all these different locations. So I'm fly fishing at one point, which I'm addicted to fly fishing. It's a really bad, at least I'm not a gear freak, so I'm not, it's not quite like a bank buster, but so I'm fly fishing one day, so I shoot me performing the song there, and I would just perform the song from beginning to end, and then I did the montage of all of the locations. And in truth, this could almost be considered what like a systems composer would do, where I could make this again and perform it in as many locations as I want and remontage it back together.
Because it's always you.
It's always me, and it's like the system is you sing while you're doing what you do.
Well, and I guess what interests me about all of this, because it's, you do covers not just of songs, but of famous historical paintings and scenes from movies, which we'll talk about, but you reimagine all these scenes in your paintings, always with a twist, always with a different perspective than was in the original, or maybe a different, like a spin on the main character or something like that. And it seems like, you know, we think of paintings on the wall or the movies as these places where people live, not in our humble little reality, but in some other kind of world. Mm-hmm. And it seems like you're kind of taking all of that back.
I'm trying. I mean, that's a really great observation. I think, again, it's the dissolve of life and quote-unquote art. I'm fine with the frame of a film frame or a cinematic frame, but this sense, so again, that sort of, I always liken it to, not always, but when I'm thinking about it and somebody's asking me about it, like that leap of off the stage that Iggy Pop took in, like, you know, 1969 is like, you know, it's 1969, baby, and then whoosh, like off the stage and into the crowd, and the crowd's like reaching out to him, like eating him up. And I mean, I'm a huge fan of the Stooges and Iggy Pop, of course. And to me, my actions are like, rather than think wanting the stage to jump off and meld with me, oh my God, and I've had that happen with Erykah Badu too. I can't even tell you, this is the most beautiful eyes I've ever seen in my life. I'm still traumatized by how glorious she is. My sense is, my sort of method is, I want to jump up on the stage. I'm like the kid that you can't keep off the stage when the band is playing. And I feel that way about painting and about the history of painting. And I feel like I do want to populate that world with things that I'm surrounded by and with the concerns I have, you know.
We're going to get back to your art, but right now I want to hear your personal backstory, starting mm-hmm. with the first line in your artist's bio. It reads as follows. Angela Dufresne is a painter originally from Connecticut, raised, however, in the town in Kansas that Dick and Perry stopped in before they killed the Clutters. That is a reference to both Olathe and Truman Capote's In Cold Blood.
Yeah, as I remember it in the book, I think he refers to this gas station on Santa Fe Trail, which is like, we used to call it cruising the Fay. I mean, there's going to be like a lot, if, you know, people from Olathe or Overland Park that I went to school with, they're going to be like, cruising the Fay, I totally remember that. It was, you know, it was like lots of bad cigarettes, lots of bad beer, and lots of bad metal, you know, and some, a lot of Zeppelin. And we would hang out in these parking lots. We would drive from one parking lot to another and, you know, socialize, try to hook up. And the things that, you know, young kids did, it was kind of like, you know, James Dean meets, I don't even know, a sad 80s movie. And there was a gas station that I think fits the description. It's not there anymore. I think it's like a Jiffy Lube now.
But why do you lead with this when you introduce yourself to the world?
I think, well, because I feel really important that I am, and that it's important that people know that I'm not just a New York artist, which I'm very happy to be a New York artist, but that I grew up, that maybe part of the sensibility, maybe part of the attitudes that my work conveys, this exuberance, this kind of lack of self-consciousness, has a Midwestern vernacular. And as a queer person growing up here, that it was like, it was hard because it was, you know, I had really great friends who I'm still in contact with that I think understood who I was even before I was. I think my parents were, you know, traumatized, you know, and they did their best. We'll leave it at that. I think they do. My dad does well now. My mom passed away in 96, but and it was, to a certain extent, I think we have to, whilst trying to be modern citizens of the world, have to also acknowledge like where we came from and understand that we bring a kind of a cosmology a constellation of things to our artworks that really matter. And I feel like the upbringing, the growing up in this, going to public schools in Olathe, has a huge part in the kind of artist I am. No matter what, I'm never going to extrapolate myself from that completely, nor do I want to.
You know, you did mention that it was hard growing up gay in the Midwest, but mm-hmm. that it was also that there was some trauma in your family around your coming out. Mm-hmm. And that's a story that you've told in in several interviews in print. And I'm curious if you would be willing to share that story with our listeners, because I think it's a pretty interesting story.
Sure. I mean, the beautiful thing is my parents cared a lot. The horrible thing is they didn't really know how to care for a queer person. So, I mean, I want to be fair to them. I don't want to slander them in some way. It was like, that's the last thing. My dad was at the opening last night. He was giddy. It was very cute. To a certain extent, my mother was always really open and she had gay friends and stuff like that. It was different when it was her own kid and she really was traumatized. She said some incredible, this is like her just channeling Betty Davis or something, I'm sure. Like, she was like, you know, at a certain point, she said, I realize now why it's so hard, because I know now I'm not going to be the most important woman in your life. Like, of course, that with no sexual connotation, but this kind of candor and emotional, like, verbosity that, like, my mother would carry around that was intense and spectacular. And in that trauma, they did decide that I should go to therapy, and I think they were thought of it as corrective, like, you know, I mean, Mike Pence therapy. Mike. But I had this wonderful therapist whose name I think was Robert Goldstein, but I'm not exactly sure because that was in 1998. And there were several instances where my life was saved by, like, a kind of, not that my life was really at risk. I have to say, it's not like being a trans person struggling through suicidal, you know, craziness that many young people are going through today. But you know, it was, I did have moments of feeling isolated and being suicidal and doing stupid things. And I survived, thank God. But it wasn't extreme, per se. So this therapist was my first therapist, as it turns out, rather than, you know, he didn't come to the sessions with the agenda to be like, you are, you know, you have to be normal. You have to, you know, like guys and get married and start breeding. It's like, okay, thank you. So I got to work out actually my problems with my parents. And like about a year into it, I was like, you guys need to go to therapy, which they never did. but I'm a high school art teacher, I think, was the same way. I was mentioning so his name was Wayne Walker, and at the time, his name still is Wayne Walker. And at the time, he, you know, I don't think he understood I was gay. He learned that later. And I remember when federally gay marriage was approved, he sent me an email saying, you've always been equal to me and you've always deserved the same rights. This is like 30 years after I graduated high school. This is a token to like how amazing that guy is, and the amazing education I had, and the people that were out there that weren't my direct family that would come to the fold and protect young people when they needed it. So
tell me more about that art teacher.
Big shout out to him, you know.
Yeah, tell me more about him.
Well, I mean, it was so I don't know if anyone, so this is Olathe North. We had a really great, I remember also a really great history, English professor who taught American Lit and blah, blah, blah. And her name was Miss Greiner, I think. She was amazing. And then Wayne had this kind of like, the people who were in the art class had this sort of like, we just sort of started lingering around there and taking the majority of our credits in the art program. And I remember I had been thrown into detention for doing something idiotic, which I can't even confess to. I can't remember what it was. It was something really stupid. And he gave me an assignment to draw self-portraits in detention. And I was always kind of like, I could draw, I had facility, and I thought I was like a hot item, and he would always kind of eye roll me and yeah, whatever, like you can draw a bottle, but what are you going to do with that? And I remember he had a wall when Andy Warhol, he put up, we all made an Andy Warhol portrait from a printout of one of his self-portrait silk screens, and it was like a school-wide homage to Andy Warhol dying, I mean, in the middle of Kansas in 1987, like, and not the middle of Kansas, in eastern Kansas, but it was pretty amazing. And And I didn't even understand Andy Warhol, so it was a gift, you know, to even be like, wait, he's thinking about this guy. Like, this must be something, you know, like what great teachers do.
It's like a provocation.
Yeah. And anyway, so I did this portrait and I brought it to class when I got out of detention. And he said, this is really good. You should go to the Art Institute and paint the figure. You should paint from life, from models. And I was so miserable and depressed and probably sexually frustrated as a kid. Cause like, so I was like, anything you say, I'll do. So I went with actually my brother's girlfriend at the time. We went and did it together. And it literally did change my life. It like shifted the whole course.
What was it you did? You took a class at the Art Institute?
Or yeah, they offer like continuing ed or for – it's like you can be a high school student or, you know, a 40-year-old person that wants to paint from the model. And they do it on Saturdays. It was super affordable and – it turns out I was good at it. So
you say it changed your life. And I mean, I understand you're saying that partly because this is the path you ended up following. But do you remember a shift that happened inside you as you experienced it that first time?
Yeah, no, it's agency. I mean, in the classic term of what someone like Judith Butler or Eve Sedgwick would talk about, I think that I suddenly felt as though, because I had no direction whatsoever in life, nor many interests except in fabulous movies. I had fantasies of becoming an actor, but I had no idea what that entailed. I suddenly I had confidence. I was excited about things. It's like that sort of transformative moment.
I'm Gina Kaufman speaking with artist Angela Dufresne. She's from Olathe. She currently lives in Brooklyn, and she's got a solo show at the Kemper. It just opened last night, and it's called Making a Scene. Stay tuned for more of her story in just a minute. This is a portrait session on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're doing a portrait session this morning with Angela Dufresne. She's an artist from Olathe who lives in New York now, and she's been telling the story of the different struggles in her childhood, but also the triumphs, like meeting an art teacher who introduced her to painting by sending her to the Art Institute for a class. Hi again, Angela.
Hello.
So I don't want to dwell too much on your coming out story, but but you have mentioned that it was challenging. And there's this piece of it that I've read about that you had to do it twice. And I have actually heard other people tell a similar story. So I think it's not as unusual as that might sound.
No, I mean, of course, it's incredibly unusual for the person going through it because it's like, oh, well, the first time was disastrous. The second time was disastrous. Like, I have to do this twice? I mean, I think really most people I know went through once or twice. My partner, Lizzie, said that it took three times to get her mother to actually like believe it. And then her mother said, well, I think maybe I might have been gay too, but I just didn't know women could be.
There is a definite generational thing, you know?
Oh, well, her mom was, really was like, her father served in World War II. So they're older. She's like the youngest of eight. And so the first time was like in a hospital. It was actually, I remember this. It sort of seeped out accidentally in Humana Hospital. My mother had lupus, and so she was up and down, going through hospital visits, let's call them. She was in and out and constantly struggling with her health. And this glorious nurse came in, this guy, and she was cracking up with him. And he walked out, and I was like, so awesome. Like, I have so many friends at the Art Institute. At this point, I'm 19, I think, and that are gay and like, or people that are just like experimenting. They wouldn't even use that language then. I was so closeted. I think I said, well, and you know, sometimes you can be in love with someone of the same sex, but it doesn't necessarily make you gay. And it was like, my mother was sharp as a tack. Like, her head reconfigured, her eyes focused in a different way, and she suddenly understood that this woman that had come over with me to, I think it was like Easter or something, to our house, was my girlfriend. And she was like, oh my God, you're gay. It's just like this dramatic thing. And it was very hard. Hard for them, hard for me. Nobody was prepared. There was no transparent back then. there was no gay characters. I mean, this is of course the ridiculous thing is we constantly go back to representation in pop culture. It's like, where's the nice lesbian besides the film with Shirley MacLaine and Audrey Hepburn, where it kind of like the book actually is explicit that they're gay. But
wait, what movie are you talking about?
I can't remember the name of it, but there are these two teachers in this girls' school, and it's very, very clear that they're lovers in some way. I remember the movie Hotel New Hampshire, and I remember waking up, like setting an alarm in my room, being like, Hotel New Hampshire is playing at 3 a.m. on Cinemax. I have to wake up and watch that scene with Jodie Foster and Nastasia Kinski. Anyway, that all aside, like it was so traumatic for my mother. I mean, she wasn't college educated. There was no exposure to parents. Like, I want to be very rigorous about saying that it was hard for me. It was hard for them. And I think if you're a parent now with all of the cultural production that's helping with representation with LGBTQ people, then you're crazy. Like, you should be able to figure out how to help your kid. I mean, not to be judgmental or anything, but back then it was different. You know, and we were, you know, Catholic, and we were East Coasterners in a way that were living in the Midwest. And I think there was also a kind of isolation that came with that for many years. But so it was very hard, and it was a kind of, you know, a really confrontational thing. And I was shut down. Like, it was like, you're not allowed to do this, you know. And then I went to the therapist. And then he was like, yeah, whatever. Let's talk about your family life. Great. And then whatever, that relationship didn't really end, but then it did eventually, because of course there was so much strain on it that it was exhausting. And I was working
with the woman who you
with my first partner, Lisa, who was amazing artist, Lisa Waring. She lives in Houston now, and she has two kids and this amazing husband, George, and we all love each other super tons still to this day. So that's great. Then I, you know, went a couple of years of just full on trauma and really depressed and working through putting all my energy into the studio and finishing education. And then I left and I met another partner, another woman who I was completely gonzo over. And I remember a mentor of mine saying, don't even bother coming out again. Like, it's really not worth it. Like, just do what you need to do and be secretive. And at that point, I was really pissed. And I'm like, hell no, I'm not being closeted. Like, this is not the way this is going to change. And that person normally, by the way, gave me the best advice ever. But I think she was being very protective of me and really didn't want me, because she could tell how traumatized I was. And I had
by the first experience.
Like, yeah. But she wasn't right. So I went through that, and, you know, I was isolated from them financially and so on and so forth for a few years. And then we figured out how to get back together. And it was pointless and stupid, but it's what happened back then. And I also think it's really great. I'm glad that you're asking, because I feel like, you know, young queers today need to know, you know, that it wasn't the same as it is now. It was tricky. It was really hard.
Part of what you've talked about in terms of what made it hard is representation in pop culture. And that makes it super interesting to me what you do in your art.
Yes. I mean, there's an urgency, a need to play with those things. And I mean, of course, some of my heroes, what's her name? Nicole Eisman, of course. Artists like Nicola Tyson, Kath Burkhart, who has been literally painting Liz Taylor since, like, I don't even know, 1985 or something. I don't know how far they go back. Was just like from a queer POV.
Point of view.
Thank you. Was super important to me. Like, the way in which you could read images against the grain and find meaning and agency for yourself as a queer person through a kind of mistranslation or...
rather than just saying, this isn't about me, this doesn't pertain.
That's right. this is something that Jose Esteban Muñez writes about, and he calls it disidentification. But it's not in a, not like you're disidentifying yourself with the culture around you. Rather, you're to a certain extent, you're in your, with your imagination, with your body, you're mutating the culture around you so that you can make it useful for you, which usually means disrupting, interrupting, or intervening with the conventional narratives.
So I'm going to talk about some specific images in this show that's at the Kemper. Yeah. I want, so one of your movie scenes, there's this one that really jumped out at me. It's called The Lonely Are the Brave. It's got a woman alone in bed with a book, and she's sort of backed into a corner, and she's looking up at you, the viewer, with maybe kind of an annoyed expression on her face. Her exact emotion is a little bit hard to pinpoint or read.
That's purposeful.
But you cannot tell right away that she's reading because a book is in the shadows.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, tell us about this image and what it's referencing.
Okay. So it's one of the School of Gina Rollins paintings. So it's,
so first of all, who is she, for those who are not familiar?
Gina Rollins is the great collaborator and sometimes author of the Cassavetes film. So she was she was married to John Cassavetes until he died, and it was 85, maybe it was 86, I can't remember. But and she's the greatest actor of all time. I mean, I don't have an opinion about that or anything. I keep saying over and over again, she could convey, like Greta Garbo, like 8,000 thoughts and feelings. She could compact that into a single second. And that painting exists for many reasons, which I'll try to go through as quickly as possible.
No,
I'd like to give
it time. Go ahead.
The full do. I've painted her, I don't know, between the monoprints and the drawings and the paintings, like 50, 60 times.
There are many images with her name on them in the labels.
And I did a series of monoprints that were about studying her movements and her facial expressions, where I don't know if you understand how monoprints work is you just paint on a glass plate and then you run it through the press and and you get an image, but there's still ink left on the plate. So then what I was doing was painting back into the ghost. They call it a ghost, which I think is sexy. And then I would turn the ghost into Gina like a few seconds later in the film to kind of study the way she would move just ever so slightly, or sometimes very extremely, her mouth, her eyes, her hair, the tilt of her neck, whatever it was, to generate pathos, to cue the audience into the complexity of her characters and with all of the ambivalences, all of the contradictions. Really, I think, really great, like, human empathy training. Like, she's a goddess this way. Garbo did great at it too, and Judy Garland did great at it too. So I painted her a lot, and then I, over the summer of 2017, I taught at the Skowhegan School of Art, which is this incredible residency in Maine, and I met this artist, historian, writer, just complete and utter esoteric knowledge freak. His name is William E. Jones. He wrote one of the essays for the catalog in the show, for the show. And I painted his portrait there at the art at the school in Skowhegan. And in the process, we got into this relationship of call and response. So he started telling me, well, you should paint me as the beheaded John the Baptist, with, like, you know, not the one where the head is on the silver platter, but where the head is floating in the Viennese style with the blood gushing out of the neck. And
he has a specific John the Baptist he'd like to be.
Yes. And so I did that. It also has a background from this incredible movie called Point Blank, a John Borman movie that's all about L.A. from the mid-60s or late 60s. I can't remember. Anyway, it's an incredible movie with Lee Grant and Angie Dickinson. So it's a fabulous film. We used some of the kind of palette things that Borman was doing for the background. And so a really participatory, like, involving my relationships and folding them right into the meringue of my work. And he also prompted me to make the ticket line painting, which is in the show, in a way. I mean, he gave me very loose parameters.
This
on
is
that.
A giant painting of people waiting in line for a movie.
Yeah, it's a kind of the prompt, the conversation that we had. I mean, I filled in all the dots. I mean, it was just literally a text message. You should do one of, because you've been painting. So he's picking up cues from my work in the get-go, but you know, because you've been doing all these frames within frames or pictures on the wall or screens, why don't you do the one where the people are standing out in front of the ticket line in the movie theater, like Reginald Marsh or Edward Hopper, and do that sort of comparative between the actual people on the street and these iconic images in movie
people propaganda. On the street doing something very ordinary.
Yep. And so I made that. I basically, I had to get approval of like whichever posters are going to be out there from
but
him.
Wait, okay. I'm sorry, but I am really still very curious about the woman with the book because
we're getting there. Okay. Yeah. So then he said, you should also do, because you've done all of these, you've done all of these really intense Gina from her 40s. He said, I want you to do one of Gina when she's young and ravishingly beautiful. Like, I want to see what you would do with that. And I was like, I'd always steered away from it in a way because I'm really hesitant of making a painting that's just like sort of indulgent in her beauty because she's so much more dynamic than that. And so, I mean, of course, I couldn't do that because it's not a fetishistic image of her beauty. One of the things as I was researching for that prompt was I found out that she was like kind of a, like, I mean, this sort of sounds like a great author or something like that. She was sort of a sickly child and she spent a lot of time reading by herself, you know, and she was a total bookworm. She's incredibly well read. And so the scene that I used to build that painting was from The Lonely and the Brave, which is a film that she did with Kurt Douglas. He's a sort of downtrodden, cynical cowboy who had served in, I think it's Korea, and he became very just disenchanted by the whole American apparatus and this whole sort of great cowboy manifest destiny. But he was a cowboy, and she is married to his best friend.
And so he's the cowboy who's, but he's kind of had enough of the cowboy thing.
He wants to be the cowboy because he's so, but he doesn't believe in that either. But he ends up slipping into the kind of hard role of the cowboy because he's really, really traumatized and can't function in like modern late capitalism. So like, you know, 9-to-5 jobs and all that stuff. He can't function in it. So he becomes even more galvanized in his identity as a cowboy. And it ends in this really crazy way. And Walter Matthau plays the police officer who's going after him. It's a great, great, great film. She plays the best friend's wife, who maybe the kid that they had together isn't actually her husband's. It might have been Kurt Douglas's. Yeah. So it's a very complicated kind of love triangle, too. And so so that's the title of the film. It's Kurt Douglas's favorite film ever, he said.
What's happening in the original movie scene?
She's waking up and hears him arriving. And I put the book in there because I've been doing a series of paintings on reading clubs, on like intergenerational reading clubs, like just people hanging out in various stages of undress. And reading books. Like, I'm just super into that as this, like...
Why?
Reading books seems to be one of the most sort of, there's been several people who have written about how maybe the most perverse thing you could do, and I don't mean that in a sexual way, but just in a way, in a kind of anti-consumerist way, is to sit around and read books.
There's also this idea that a woman in bed, an image of a woman in bed, that you kind of take all of the implications out of it by putting the book there, in a way.
Is that right?
I don't know. In a way, like, it's like that a woman in bed does not have to be doing something sexual. She can just be reading a book.
Yeah. I mean, although there are very sexy things about reading books in bed, too.
I agree. Angela Dufresne, we'll be right back. We're talking to Angela Dufresne. She's an artist. She's got a show at the Kemper Museum right now. She's from Olathe and lives in New York. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm talking with Angela Dufresne. She's got a show up now called Making a Scene at the Kemper Museum. And Angela, I want to ask you about that title, Making a Scene. What does it mean to you?
Well, I mean, the amazing curator, Aaron, came up with that. But I don't think there could be a better title for not just, you know, you think the figurative works, the ones that seem to be based in a kind of classical, like theatrical tableau, but even the way I handle landscapes, it's a way in which, as we talked about earlier, that I'm taking these existing scenes and remaking them and intervening with them and bringing this irreverent, kind of critical intervention and play within the scenes that we think we are normally going to see. But I would say I'm not a narrative painter. I don't think that any of these paintings have like a script per se that say, oh, this is how you should read it and this is the meaning you should glean from it. I'm sort of building narrative conditions for the viewer to partake in and read how they need to. So sort of like making a scene for visual.
I hear it in some ways also when I think there are three videos, and in all of them, you do a lot of getting naked,
mm-hmm.
and you're making a scene.
Oh,
in
that
your
was
own
also
way,
I think
my
Aaron
too.
Chose that title because of the provocativeness of it. Like, yeah, I mean, like I said irreverence, but I think like, I would never want to make work that was its sole purpose would be to shock or provoke. Because I don't know, I'm too. I think I would suffer too much from that. I don't think it's that interesting of an emotional operation. It's too single. It's too goal-oriented. It's like bad goal-oriented sex
well,
or something.
Well, then the shock wears off and it's
and then it's like, okay, now what? Happened. Now what are we doing? But I do tend to like really shocking work. So it's not like I'm not kin to that. But I think the sense of trying, like in The Man That Got Away or in the Nico song, for instance. So one of the videos is a cover of Nico's My Only Child. And this sense of like, you know, almost every moment of every day as human beings, as bodies, as whether we're queer or straight, whatever it is, you know, whatever our ethnicity is, some people, of course, have to suffer more. They shouldn't have to, but it seems as though people feel like that's the way it should be. We are being humiliated to a certain extent. The things that we're living, our desires, our passions, our fears, our beliefs, are against the grain of what we're surrounded by. And it seems like it doesn't especially...
What we're surrounded by in what way? Like on TV or...
On television. I mean, I think if you go to the mall to a certain extent, you see bodies that to a certain extent are normative against like maybe you're a queer body or maybe you're not a healthy looking skinny waspy person, you know what I mean? Like there is then trauma in negotiating these things, and we're constantly navigating these things and marketing. All elements of spectacle in our society are competing with what our actual bodies kind of want to do. I mean, here I'm going to sound Freudian in a way, right? And what our bodies do, which sometimes are not the most glamorous things, you know, like having a cold and having, you know, fluids ooze out of your eyes and ears and nose. You know,
I'm just imagining seeing that that on like a on a sign in a fancy store, you know, where they show the clothes on the person.
Yeah,
the runny
exactly,
nose.
Exactly. So this sense that to a certain extent, you know, we are these visceral. Bodies that are doing these like basic biological things. I wouldn't necessarily go all the way as to abject, but we're these bodies that have like that are crazy. It's crazy that we walk around as these things, and you know, I think in True Blood they call them like the or sacks of blood or something, which I love that term. Like this, and it to a certain extent, it's always traumatic. It's always humiliating, and to a certain extent, the performance of normativity and sociality is such that we are concealing those things all the time. And so I'm interested in challenging those concealments, you know, but in a playful, affectionate way, not in a way that you know, I think this is a surrealist operation that the great surrealists like Hans Bellmer or Louise Bourgeois are interested in doing.
I should say, like, you do bring humor to it. And yes. I think a person could imagine that you're just being funny, which I also suspected was not the case, because it seems like, that there's there have been like some kind of decisions made about who's allowed to be naked in a video and who isn't. And I thought it was cool that you put yourself out there.
Yeah, it's something that I want the paintings to feel really live on stage, like to where you can feel their making and you can feel their the energy that went into making them. And I want the videos to feel that way too. This sense of like, I am accessible. I'm available in these works. I'm not, the works aren't a barricade between me and the world.
One of these paintings references Kansas City very directly.
Oh, yeah.
And it is called Hazardous Forest. It's a very colorful, very chaotic scene with Liberty Memorial is in the background.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Well, last time I came to visit, I did the, it wasn't the site visit. I came in September of 2017 to visit my family. And I snuck off to see the Liberty Memorial because I'd never gone. I had gone up into the tower, and I had gone up into the murals that are in there back in the early 90s. I barely remembered them. I remember them being really amazing, which I think is an overstatement. They're cool, but I had never seen the museum, and I had some time, and I thought it would be a great thing to do with my dad, and so I said, come over and meet me. And I was there for about an hour before he got to me. And the museum blew me away, actually. I think it tells the story, the ambivalences, the contradictions, and the like catastrophic stupidity of that war and of the pointlessness of it and of the mistakes that were made on all sides. And I was like, wow, this is a really morally upstanding, amazing institution. I mean, I was kind of like, whoa, like, I'm so happy I did this. And you know, there's a little bit of fetishization of how fabulous industrial design was back then, which I also really enjoyed. I mean, like all the leather goods and the shoes. It's like I wanted to buy one of everything. I mean, that's like, wait, this is so wrong that I'm doing this. But you know, the war, you know, technology stuff, which I don't think we should fetishize ever. I think it's wrong, but I don't think they're really doing that. I think they're really just trying to tell the history. So let me make that clear. But so I was really moved by it, and I was thinking about doing a painting. I've been thinking about doing paintings specifically about Kansas City for a while, and I had had friends who had viral converted HIV in that park back in the 80s.
The Penn Valley Park.
Yep. And, you know, they died. Like, there was, you know, the Reagan administration was withholding the drugs, and they didn't get treatment. It was really early 90s. I remember Jeff died in 91. So, and these were, like, people I went through art school with. I met when we were 18 years old, you know, like...
A different kind of war, I guess.
Yeah, and it was maybe different than the, like... I mean, it was still big, but it was different than the San Francisco, New York... epidemics, but it was big and really impactful in our community.
Well, our time is up, but Angela Dufresne, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thanks.
Angela's a painter. Her solo show is up now at the Kemper. It's called Making a Scene, and this has been a portrait session. Our portrait session partner is photographer Paul Andrews. And if you didn't catch this whole conversation, you can do that at kcur.org/Central Standard later today. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Coy Duggar, Kathleen Pointer, and Suzanne Hogan, with intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Linda Scher runs the board, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman.